Hello and welcome to Science World. A historic first was announced by NASA last week. A space probe it launched 36 years ago became the first ever human-made object to sail out of our solar system and into the space between the stars. Today we talk with a man who has played a very important role in the Voyager program since its inception. Richard Paul will also tell us about a unique calling card the Voyager has strapped to its side. It's a golden record that contains a variety of music and sounds of Earth. It was meant as a way to introduce our planet to any aliens that might come in contact with the Voyager. And this week, NASA also launched a new private rocket that will bring supplies to the International Space Station. This and more are coming up for you on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. Private industry's ability to handle resupply missions to the International Space Station was tested once again on Wednesday when a second U.S. company launched its own rocket and spacecraft toward the ISS. Suzanne Presto has more.
We have liftoff.
And we have liftoff of Antares, beginning the journey of the G. David Lowe Cygnus cargo vehicle to the International Space Station.
The Virginia-based company Orbital Sciences showed it could launch a resupply mission to the ISS with a picture-perfect liftoff from the Mid-Atlantic Regional Spaceport in Virginia. Orbital's Cygnus spacecraft, launched atop its Antares rocket, is loaded with 700 kilograms of cargo bound for the station's crew. This demonstration mission is the final part of a NASA program, in which the U.S. Space Agency acted as a lead investor in the private sector's development of space transportation. Such partnerships are the wave of the future, says former NASA astronaut and Orbital's executive vice president, Frank Culbertson.
This is the way of the future. This is how we're going to have to operate going forward in order to maintain a robust space program. And I think we're demonstrating it can be done. But this was just step one of the hard part. Step two is coming up as we begin the rendezvous and the maneuvers to get to the station.
The United States is relying on private industry to ferry cargo to the station, while NASA focuses on developing the next generation of spacecraft. During Cygnus's flight, several of the craft's systems and capabilities will be tested. It is expected to dock with the station on Sunday. NASA has awarded Orbital a $1.9 billion contract for resupply missions. The California-based company SpaceX holds a $1.6 billion resupply contract. SpaceX developed the Falcon 9 rocket and Dragon space capsule. The Dragon docked with the station last year, making history as the first private craft to do so. The company's crafts are not interchangeable, says Alan Lindenmoyer, manager of NASA's Commercial Crew and Cargo Program.
SpaceX has the ability to carry up mass cargo and return cargo from the International Space Station. Orbital has actually a larger pressurized volume, so they're able to carry a larger quantity of less dense cargo if needed.
Orbital's Cygnus craft will be filled with the station's trash, and after about a month, it will undock. Unlike SpaceX's Dragon, Orbital's Cygnus is designed to burn up upon re-entering Earth's atmosphere. Suzanne Presto, VOA News, Washington.
Today we're marking the history-making accomplishments of NASA's Voyager 1. With that in mind, today's Science World Quick Quiz is about that achievement. Before Voyager could enter interstellar space, it had to pass through the outer boundary of our solar system. What is this region of space called by scientists? Is it A, heliopause, B, termination shock, or C, Oort cloud? Think about it and see if you can come up with the right answer. We'll reveal the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
Imagine having an idea, sketching it on paper, bringing it to a store, and seeing that drawing turned into a physical object in a matter of hours. Well, this is now possible for the average consumer with the help of 3D or 3D printers. Elizabeth Lee tells us more.
Brian Jaycox and his wife love to play with high-tech toys. They opened the Build Shop LLC in Los Angeles 2 years ago. It's filled with tools like a laser cutter, an industrial sewing machine, and various 3D printers. They offer 3D printing classes and services for anyone who is interested.
I think 3D printing is going to be huge. I think it's going to make a huge impact on society as a whole.
Slightly less volume of binder.
One of the students in this class is Ki-Chong Tran. He plans to open a 3D print shop in Cambodia.
I envision a place where people can come in with ideas, a drawing or just anything on a napkin, and we can convert that drawing into a file and then 3D print it.
3D printing services are popping up for consumers all across the United States. The UPS Store, a nationwide retailer that provides services that include shipping and copying, recently installed 3D printers in three of its franchises. Burke Jones owns this one in San Diego.
Well, the demand has been amazing. It's been much more than I would have imagined.
The UPS Store plans to add 3D printers in three additional stores. Company executive Mark Denny says customers come from diverse backgrounds.
Anybody that has a startup, any inventors, engineers, have a need to produce something like this.
For $11, Jonathan Netter used the 3D printer to produce two small plastic parts that would make up an artificial knuckle. Netter works for a medical device company that is testing finger prosthetics. He says the same day or next day service will speed up the testing phase and get the prosthetic to patients faster.
I'd say it would save us probably about a year of testing time.
And as with any technology, experts expect the printing speed and price to improve. Currently, Brian Jaycox charges $15 an hour to print an object, plus a fee depending on the size of the object, and up to $50 an hour for design and labor services. At the UPS store, the cost of the object depends on the amount of materials used. It charges up to $95 an hour to design the object, with software that creates a digital file which allows the printer to produce it. Jaycox predicts that in 5 years, 3D printing technology could become more consumer-friendly. But Ki-Chong Tran says even current technology can make a difference in a developing country such as Cambodia.
With 3D printing, you can't give them tools, you put it in their hands, so they're responsible more for their own development. And they learn skills beyond just like learning English and being a tour guide or something like that, or working at a bank. They can actually create things that, you know, give value to the world.
And he says it's not just Cambodia. Anywhere in the world where there is a 3D printer, it can turn a good idea into reality. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
With nearly a decade of successful commercial production, the use of biological resources like soybeans or corn oil has become important and popular additives to diesel fuels. As Jan Sluzer reports, there's a new and promising source for biodiesel fuel on the horizon, algae.
Among the American companies making biodiesel is Propel Fuels, based in Redwood City, California. Matt Horton is its CEO.
We think the key to transformation in the United States, to changing the fuel mix, is engaging those consumers, giving them options, educating them about the fuels, and then people take care of the rest. So what Propel's really about is giving people new choices, bringing new kinds of fuels, alternative fuels, cleaner fuels, to retail stations everywhere.
Propel products are available at 29 gas stations nationwide. Last year, it partnered with Solazyme, another local company with similar goals and philosophy. For 10 years, Solazyme has been working to find replacements for petroleum. Bob Ames, the company's vice president in charge of fuels, says what they've come up with is unique.
So it all starts in the lab, where what we do is we grow a proprietary strain of algae that are actually optimized to produce an oil that is a perfect oil, an algae oil, to make into fuel.
Solazyme has patented its algae oil technology. Ames says the possibilities for the fast-growing aquatic plant are just beginning to be discovered. But Solazyme is especially excited about its algae-derived fuel because of its environmental benefits.
It's significantly cleaner. So things like the particulate matter, the black soot coming out the back of a diesel pipe, that's significantly reduced when you use an algae-based fuel.
To test its marketability, Propel installed algae-based fuel pumps at 4 of its 7 stations in the San Francisco Bay Area. This was the first time Solazyme's new biodiesel was offered to the public. The companies were pleased to see that over the month-long test run, there was a 35% increase in biodiesel sales.
Basically, it was offered at exactly the same price as a competing fuel, and what consumers told us by buying more of it is that they were willing to buy it because of the better environmental benefits.
Matt Horton says the technology is ready. The fuel works, and consumers want it. A plus for algae is that it can be densely grown. So what's the problem? Horton says simply, economics.
You have to be able to produce these fuels in very, very large quantities to drive the prices down so that they're competitive.
Large quantities of Solazyme's algae oil are being produced at its plant in Peoria, Illinois, as well as at a much smaller facility near San Francisco. A much larger facility, expected to be in operation by the end of the year, is currently under construction in Brazil, in partnership with a Brazilian company. While no one expects algae-based fuel to replace petroleum, those who believe in its potential say it could help put the world on a cleaner and more energy-efficient road to the future. For VOA News, I'm Jan Sluzer in San Francisco.
Do you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz? Well, let's find out. Before Voyager could enter interstellar space, it had to pass through the outer boundary of the solar system. What is this region of space called by scientists? Is it A, the heliopause, B, termination shock, or C, Oort cloud? The answer is A, heliopause. It's the outer edge of an immense magnetic bubble called the heliosphere, which contains our solar system, the solar wind, and the entire solar magnetic field. By the way, this giant solar bubble extends well beyond the orbit of Pluto. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World.
Last week, NASA announced that its Voyager 1 spacecraft, launched in September 1977, made history when it became the first human-made object to leave our solar system and enter the space between the stars. While the original mission for Voyager 1 and its sister probe, Voyager 2, was to explore the areas of our solar system that contain the great outer planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, the spacecraft will now give scientists the unique opportunity to study what was never before possible. A couple of years ago, as the Voyager was entering the outer portion of the solar system, or heliopause, we spoke with Dr. Edward Stone, who has been the project scientist for the Voyager program since pretty near its inception. Dr. Stone joins us once again to talk about this history-making spacecraft, its accomplishments, and what is hoped will be learned as it ventures beyond our solar system. Dr. Stone, when do you think Voyager 1 actually left our solar system for interstellar space?
Well, the Voyager spacecraft, Voyager 1, we believe left the solar bubble, this bubble the sun creates around itself, on August 25th of 2012. And that's when it first entered the space between the stars, interstellar space.
So how were you and your colleagues on the Voyager program able to finally determine this?
We got very lucky in the sense that although we don't have a working solar wind instrument, and so we could not directly measure the ion density, which is the electron density, which really tells us whether we're inside or outside. Inside, the solar wind density is quite low. Outside, it's about 100 times denser. It's colder and denser plasma outside. So we had to rely on a bit of luck in the sense that the eruption on the sun in March of 2012, it was like a tsunami wave, which finally reached Voyager 1 in April of this year. And when it did, it caused the plasma there to oscillate. And the frequency told us this was dense plasma. This was the interstellar plasma, not the solar wind plasma.
How far away is Voyager 1 from Earth?
It's about almost 12 billion miles now. In fact, today it's about 125 times as far from the sun as the Earth is.
And it must give you a great feeling to know that something you were involved with since its beginning was able to accomplish such an historic feat, being the first human-made object to leave the solar system.
Yes, it's really very exciting because we had been planning or hoping for this right really from the very beginning of the mission in 1972 that we'd hope to reach interstellar space. Of course, we had no idea how big the bubble was, and we had no idea how long a spacecraft could last. So this is really a wonderful thing which happened now that we've actually gotten there while we still have electrical power and we can begin a mission exploring interstellar space for the first time.
Now, when Voyager 1 was launched back in 1997, did you have any idea that this spacecraft would reach interstellar space?
We hoped. We hoped it would, and it was one of our mission objectives. We began the mission as a 4-year mission to Saturn. When that happened successfully for both spacecraft, we then entered what was called the Voyager Uranus interstellar mission. So that was in 1980 already that we had sent Voyager 1 on its journey to interstellar space. We just had no idea how far it was, nor did we know if the spacecraft could last so long. 36 years in space is really, it's a record. No other spacecraft have lasted so long in space.
Just how functional is Voyager 1 at this point? What kind of data is coming back?
We have four instruments that are key. We have the magnetometer, which measures the magnetic field, which is carried out from the sun by the solar wind, and outside the magnetic field is carried by the interstellar wind. That's the galactic magnetic field. Then we have two instruments which measure the more energetic ions, those which have been accelerated up to, say, 5% or more of the speed of light. The low-energy charged particles are the slowest of those. And then we have the cosmic ray particles, which are atomic nuclei accelerated up to 10 or more percent the speed of light by those supernovae explosions millions of years ago. And then the fourth instrument we have on Voyager 1, which actually measured the oscillations in the plasma, is called the Plasma Wave Science Instrument, which can't measure the ions directly, but measures whenever they get pinged by something from the sun, just like striking a bell. There will be a tone which the plasma wave instrument can detect. We have no further tones at this time because the sun has not been very active, but hopefully there will be more opportunities.
Considering that the Voyager 1 is now in interstellar space, what are you most personally curious to learn about it?
Well, we like to understand the magnetic field because the magnetic field in interstellar space is not the direction we expected. And this may have to do with the fact that the interstellar wind carries that magnetic field up to the heliosphere and then wraps it around it. And in that wrapping, the direction is different than we expected. So there's something we don't understand about the interstellar magnetic field and its wrapping around. We also want to measure very accurately for the first time the lowest energy galactic cosmic rays, these things which were accelerated during the supernova explosion, which cannot get into the bubble. They're only observable in where we are now. And so for the first time, we can actually determine the full intensity of the galactic cosmic rays, which are outside of the solar bubble. And, of course, we're hoping that we will have more opportunity to measure the plasma because we already know that the plasma density is increasing as the spacecraft moves away. That means that the interstellar wind, as it approaches the heliosphere, is like water approaching a rock in a stream. It has to sort of pile up right in front of the heliosphere, and that's what we're going to be looking at, is the piling up of the interstellar plasma just outside our heliosphere.
And finally, Dr. Stone, what about Voyager 1 sister spacecraft Voyager 2? Is it still functioning as well as Voyager? And if so, what's its status?
It's doing very well. In fact, it has a fifth instrument, which is missing on Voyager 1, that's not working on Voyager 1. That's the plasma instrument. So we can measure directly the density of the solar wind, its speed, and its temperature. And what we know is that the solar wind at Voyager 2 is maintaining its speed, but it's turning because it has to turn. It cannot go through the boundary. It has to turn and run basically along the boundary back in the tail of the heliosphere, which is a comet-shaped object. So we expect that we may cross into interstellar space in another 3 or 4 years. And when we do, we will directly at that time be able to determine that the plasma density did in fact change by roughly a factor of 100 in going from inside to outside.
That was physicist and professor Dr. Edward Stone, project scientist for NASA's Voyager program since 1972. As the Voyager 1 sails in interstellar space, it carries an unusual calling card designed to introduce Earth to any alien being that the Voyager might pass. Richard Paul has the story.
Traveling now billions of kilometers out in space are the voices and sounds of humans and animals living on Earth in 1977. They're bolted to the side of Voyager 1 in the form of a gold-plated phonograph record containing the sounds of our planet. Tim Ferriss mixed the audio that went on the record.
The record is a conventional long-playing phonograph record, except that it's made of copper and it's covered in gold, and then it's put inside a titanium case to protect it.
Ferriss was one of a small group of people who worked to convince NASA to attach the record to Voyager's side. The original idea, according to Annie Drian, another member of the group, came from astronomer Frank Drake at the University of California.
We wanted to convey to the extraterrestrials what it was like to be alive in the beautiful spring of 1977. And it seemed to Frank that the best way to compress as much information as possible in a very small space was to do it on a phonograph record.
And there's plenty of information there. The record contains greetings in 59 human languages.
Hello from the children of planet Earth.
It has 118 pictures of life on Earth and 27 pieces of music, exemplifying, Tim Ferriss says, the diversity of human creation.
So there's music on the record from Europe and the United States. But also from Africa and the South Pacific and South America. Georgia and Russia and, you know, all these places, China, India.
Shortly after American astronauts returned from space in 1968, NASA released a photograph of the Earth rising from behind the moon. According to Margaret Weidekamp, a curator at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, that photo deeply touched people like Drake and his partner on the Gold Record Project, the scientist and TV celebrity Carl Sagan.
Knowing that that picture was taken by a human being, I think profoundly changed the thoughts of these people and really made them start thinking about, if we are this, you know, pale blue dot in this ocean of vastness, then how do we communicate something about who we are?
It made them think carefully about how they might convey the greetings, the art, and the talent of all humanity, not just the nation that sent the spacecraft up. The technology they used may seem archaic today, but actually, Margaret Weidekamp says it has advantages over some of today's gadgets.
It's a really durable technology that has proven to be a great way to record sound. If you have digital sound, you have to have the right software in order to decode it, or it doesn't work.
And she says if a spacecraft were launched today with a message from aliens, it might still be a wise technology to use. So that's the medium. As for the message they chose, Tim Ferriss says you couldn't have picked anything better.
You can't say that an Indian raga or a piece by Bach or a Japanese shakuhachi piece, you can't say it means something that you can put into words. It is its own end product. It means really what it is, similar to things in nature. A flower isn't a way of expressing something else. It's the end product. It is what it is.
For VOA News, I'm Richard Paul.
That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.